from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am your host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this cloudy, cold afternoon. We have a very crowded show for you today, so let's kick it off. Days before the annual March for Life, the West Virginia House of Delegates has passed a bill that would penalize physicians who don't provide medical care to babies surviving abortion. Now, Democrats are calling it an election year stunt, but the passage was 93 yeas to 5 nays. Hard to argue with those numbers. West Virginia State Senator Patricia Rucker joins me to discuss. In our second block, First Liberty has begun the next phase of its defense of Shields of Strength, a private company that makes replica dog tags with Bible verses to encourage our servicemen and women. This time, it's not the U.S. Army causing a ruckus, but the Marine Corps. Chief of Staff Mike Berry joins me to discuss. At the bottom of the hour, sex ed has come a long way from a simplistic version of the birds and the bees. And if the Massachusetts version of sex ed is any indication, it's gone way too far. Andrew Beckwith, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, joins me with the breakdown of what's called the Healthy Youth Act, just passed by the Massachusetts Senate and sending graphic and comprehensive sex ed curriculum into all Massachusetts public schools. And in my last segment, the veil may finally be lifting on the terrorist regime that is Iraq. An exclusive Reuters investigation in 2018 revealed serious evidence of Iran's missile transference to Iraq, its use of Iraq as a forward missile base, and its history of doing the same in Syria and Yemen. Dr. Kanta Ahmed, visiting fellow for the Independent Women's Forum, Muslim scholar, and member of the Shoah Foundation, will join me to discuss how the world may finally be paying attention. As a reminder, our podcast can be found at TonyPerkins.com. You can find our podcast everywhere you play your podcasts. And because it's relevant to this first section and we are approaching the annual March for Life, let me encourage you to go to endbirthdayabortion.com. This is our campaign to send 90,000 baby hats to Congress in an effort to get them to view things the right way when it comes to the science of life and caring for babies who cannot be cared for. We are very committed to the cause of life here at FRC. And for more information on where your state stands on pro-life issues and pro-life protections, go to frc.org/pro-life map. You can also find at our website our issue brief on the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Acts we see passing the country and state by state. And again, go to End Birthday Abortion to participate in our campaign to get the message to Congress to protect the unborn. Well, the West Virginia House of Delegates has passed a bill 93-5 that would penalize physicians who don't provide medical care to a baby born after an abortion attempt. Now, the measure hasn't been sent to the Senate yet, and joining me now to talk more about it is West Virginia State Senator Patricia Rucker. Senator, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what this particular bill means for the pro-life community.
So I have to say that obviously it is really sad that we even have to have this discussion have to pass this bill. To me, it is something that it just seems inherently correct. In our country, you are afforded the right to life. And you know, as tragic as it is that we allow women to have abortions for various reasons, if a child happens to survive that procedure, you know, they are now born. That means inherently they should have the same rights that every person born should have.
Right.
And
absolutely,
that means medical care, every possible protection we can provide them. And this Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act essentially just treats that child born during an abortion the same as any child born alive at whatever gestational age, you know, whether it's a premature child or one that, you know, a mother went to the hospital in order to have the baby on time kind of thing. I mean, we just want them to be treated the same.
So it is shocking to me, again, like you said, that we even need legislation that specifically says provide medical care to an infant that survives an abortion. But there was a significant amount of PR pushback from the Democrats on this bill, which, again, passing at 93-5 indicates to me that the majority of them went along with it anyway. But quite a number of them said that the legislation itself was unnecessary. Delegate John Doyle, for example, who's a Dem from Jefferson County, it proposes to make something illegal that is already illegal. But my guess is you take a different perspective on this and that we do need legislation like that.
Well, you know, I'm afraid to say that, you know, there are other areas in the country that have actually said and done the opposite. And whether or not it's happening here in West Virginia, one of the, you know, I think it is important that we do say we do not accept that and that there be penalties to a doctor or a medical facility who does not do what we all consider, including Delegate Doe, what right. should be the proper thing to do. So if it's not happening, it does not hurt. There's no problem then. We're all good. But I hope that that's the case. Unfortunately, I can't be completely confident.
Well, and we know that putting a law on the books at least concretizes the protection that we need, because bills can always be repealed. And with the complaints that this is an unnecessary piece of legislation, my response is, well, then what's the harm in signing it and passing it in the first place? Should the laws change in the future, you have on record, on the books in West Virginia, a piece of legislation that has specifically protected those who are born alive and survive an abortion. Now, the bill itself calls on doctors to use reasonable medical judgment in the event of an unsuccessful abortion. Where's the wiggle room in something like that? So we're leaving this up to physicians to make what is essentially a bottom of the ninth decision. They are on the line to determine whether or not this is a child who would conceivably survive, what extent of medical care is given. So are we giving them too much leeway by allowing the use of reasonable medical judgment? Does that bother you at all?
Well, I will tell you that it is important whenever we do pass a bill that we understand that conditions, you know, on the ground are different, and you cannot possibly in a bill include every single possibility. So we do not want to dictate medical judgments. That really is not, I don't think it's appropriate for legislation, nor is it appropriate, you know, in a state code. What is important with the terms, you know, reasonable and prudent, those kind of terms, that not only do the doctors, you know, they have a way of enforcing themselves. The discipline that we put in this bill is that they will be subject to their licensure board review, and they may lose. It's not necessarily, but they may lose their professional license to practice. And that is currently how we do judge, you know, when there is a question as to whether a physician did or did not intentionally or recklessly do something. And I believe that that should continue. What is even more important is that any person who feels that something was done wrong, they have a right to make that claim and to get it looked into. So I think that, you know, we're providing a way to protect these babies, giving people an ability to, you know, have that chance to say if they felt that the doctor needs, you know, did not do everything that he could, and then, you know, some real serious consequences if the medical professionals who oversee physicians agree.
Now, this bill mirrors very closely the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. In your mind, does this signal a shift in national pro-life support around the country?
Well, I would like to say so. I can't really judge, but I will tell you that definitely here in West Virginia, I'm very happy to say we are a state that does care about life, and we have made great strides to protecting life almost every single year of the legislative sessions that I've been part of.
Now, as someone who represents constituents, you may have people who are interested in supporting pro-life issues in their own states. What's your recommendation to them for our listeners?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of what you said.
What's your encouragement to listeners who would like to support pro-life issues in their own states? What's your recommendation?
Okay. Well, I hope that everyone considers it worth their time to just send an email or make a phone call to their legislators. We need to hear from you. We need to know you care about this, and this is important to you. And some folks believe that, oh, this is just common sense. It's definitely going to pass. It's not important. But you never, never know until you actually get that bill signed. All sorts of things could happen. I will point out to, you know, folks that here in West Virginia, we have passed legislation before from both houses, and then the governor has vetoed it. So, you know, the governor also needs to hear folks support this. And there's actually many measures in our both the House and the Senate that further protect life. There are at least three or four other bills that you could consider pro-life bills. All of these deserve attention, and all of them are important because every single step we take to protect life is, you know, one step closer to our ultimate goal, which is to protect life at all times for everyone, no matter their age, no matter what stage.
Now, as it heads to the Senate, and we've got about a minute left here, how do you anticipate your colleagues in the Senate will rule on this bill?
So I haven't really spoken yet with our, you know, caucus about this bill, but I think that there's going to be plenty of support. I introduced the same legislation on the Senate side, and anyone can look. I have lots of sponsors for it, so I suspect it's going to get passed.
West Virginia State Senator Patricia Rucker has been my guest today on Washington Watch. For more information, go to frc.org/pro-life map to determine what the protections are in your state, and go to tonyperkins.com for more information about the bill and today's guests. Coming up, the second phase of First Liberty's defense of Shields of Strength, a private company that makes dog tags with Bible verses, has launched against the U.S. Marine Corps. Chief of Staff Mike Berry joins me to discuss on Washington Watch.
Join FRC live via webcast for the 15th annual Pro-Life Con Digital Action Summit. On January 24th, from FRC's headquarters in Washington, you'll hear from political leaders, bloggers, journalists, and activists who will share how they view social media and other digital tools to further the pro-life message. You'll be empowered to better reach your own communities by learning best practices from those who are at the cutting edge of the digital pro-life movement. Tune in Friday, January 24th at 8 a.m. at prolifecon.com.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found. Or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever hear the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Masculinity is under attack in our culture. The American Psychological Association released guidelines declaring traditional masculinity ideology as harmful. Brown University, an Ivy League school, offered a course, Unlearning Toxic Masculinity, explaining that rigid definitions of masculinity are toxic to men's health. And a University of Texas class, Masculine UT, treated masculinity as if it were a mental health crisis. Thankfully, the culture does not have the last word on true masculinity. God does. Our Stand Courageous Men's conferences offer biblical solutions to the crisis of manhood. We seek to help men develop character, cultivate habits, build relationships, and make commitments that will move them closer to God's design. Check out StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com. What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, president of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at FRCblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at FRCblog.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It's Friday, which means I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast site, and we are all over every podcast outlet. So visit us there. FRC.org for more information on our pro-life activities and initiatives. And don't forget to visit EndBirthdayAbortion.com. Well, the Marines have been a cornerstone of service and sacrifice since 1775, and our own Tony Perkins served as a sergeant in that branch. But the Marines have recently based their opinions on whether or not religion is permissible on the shoulders of an individual who is an activist and a secular humanist. They've banned faith-based dog tags, replica dog tags, to the dismay of servicemen and women of faith. So joining me now to discuss his defense of family-owned company Shields of Strength is Chief of Staff for First Liberty, Mike Berry, who served himself as a Marine in Afghanistan. Mike, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, it's great to be back on. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to talk a little procedure first, because this is actually the second defense that you've taken up on behalf of Shields of Strength. You sent an initial demand letter about a month ago. Can you tell me where you went first?
Yeah, that's right. Our first letter went to the U.S. Army's trademark office. Each branch of the service has their own trademark and licensing office. These are typically run by, I think, what we would all affectionately refer to as government bureaucrats deep in the bowels of the Pentagon. So I want to make sure our listeners know these are not uniformed people in the military who are making these decisions. These are, the suit and tie types that work in the Pentagon. And, we each branch, like I said, has their own office. And because Shields of Strength has licenses with the Army, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force, we sort of have to do this piecemeal approach and take them one at a time.
So the Army was first. Now it's the Marines. Let's talk a little bit about the company. The company is a private company. Is that correct? So no official governmental regulation or affiliation. A private company using official insignias, official seals, pursuant to the licenses that they have. Both the branches have pulled the licenses. But can you make the argument that the use of the seal was an official endorsement of religion by the government?
Well, it's not, you know, an official endorsement. And for someone like, you know, Mikey Weinstein, who is the aforementioned activist,
right,
who filed these complaints, that's ridiculous, right? I don't think anybody who goes into a base exchange and buys one of these thinks that somehow the United States of America and its government is telling them, you must believe a certain thing, or you must believe a certain way, or have a certain religious belief, simply because they're choosing to buy with their own money, mind you, a replica dog tag that they, you know, for either themselves or their family members or their buddies. And here's the other thing to keep in mind: the licensing program that the government has, you know, is sort of defending here, has only been around since about the 2011-2012 timeframe. So for years, and we've been contacted, First Liberty Institute's been contacted by other companies who make military memorabilia, and they're sort of coming out of the woodwork and saying, hey, we saw, you know, you guys talking about Show the Strength. This is happening to us too. We've been in business for, you know, 20 years, 30 years in some instances, and we've been shut down by these trademark offices for designs that we ourselves create, our own intellectual property, but because the government went in and trademarked it, you know, years later, they're now claiming that they have the right to stop us from using something that we created. So it's getting really out of hand. It's and again, you know, I think our listeners need to be reminded that this all started from Mikey Weinstein's complaint, because in the email that we received from the Army telling our client, Shields of Strength, hey, you need to stop making these replica dog tags, the subject line of the email said negative press, and then it cited the news article that was covering Mikey Weinstein. So that's what really started all this.
So really, if you just complain loud enough, you can get anyone's religious freedom encroached upon, right?
Right, but you know who the real victims are here are the individual Marines, because Shields of Strength was contacted just a couple weeks ago by about a unit of about 2,000 Marines in Camp Pendleton, California, who requested an order, or excuse me, they were contacted by a unit in Camp Pendleton requesting an order for 2,000 Shields of Strength dog tags. Now, these are Marines, and especially given current events or recent events, who are very likely to find themselves in harm's way in the Persian Gulf region in the very near future. And these are very simple reminders of faith that our Marines are absolutely entitled to have. And yet, Kenny Vaughn, who's the founder and owner of Shields of Strength, has tragically, and he's heartbroken that he has to tell these Marines, no, I'm sorry, I can't fulfill your order right now because I've got this legal threat by the trademark office.
Oh, how ridiculous that you are impeded in the exercise of your religion when someone complains loud enough, and he's having to turn down precisely the requests of these servicemen and women who are encouraged by wearing this particular replica tag around their necks. So you've dealt with the trademark office in both branches. Tell me what your gut's telling you about a potential reversal of the ban.
Well, I can say this, that the Army sent us what I would call a fairly lukewarm but positive response. You know, it wasn't exactly what I had hoped for in terms of, we made a huge mistake and we're so sorry and we really value your relationship with Shields of Strength. But it was okay. You know, yeah, we probably should have worded it differently. We didn't mean that you can't have, you know, that you have to stop producing these things and so on and so forth. But to my surprise, the U.S. Marine Corps doubled down and said, no, if you continue doing this, we're going to shut you down.
And that's where it stands now. We are waiting for further developments. Thank you for taking up the cause of Shields of Strength and for the servicemen and women who use these as tools of encouragement in what they do on behalf of those of us in the nation who do not serve. Coming up next, we have a Massachusetts Senate bill just passed, the Healthy Youth Act. It sounds benign, but it mandates the use of a sex ed curriculum that is anything but. Andrew Beckwith of the Massachusetts Family Institute will join me coming up next.
Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with 5 kids under the age of 9, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a 6-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a 2-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast site. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. While education is an issue near and dear to my heart as the mother of 3 in public school, so the next story particularly riles me. The Massachusetts Senate voted 33-2 on Thursday to approve a bill called the Healthy Youth Act. Now, this sounds benign enough, but it hides something pretty nefarious. It requires all public school districts in Massachusetts that teach sex ed to use state-approved curricula that include detailed descriptions of non-procreative sex acts that I blush to even mention on the air. Now to talk with me about this new bill is the president at the Massachusetts Family Institute, Andrew Beckwith, who is also an allied attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom. Andrew, welcome to Washington Watch.
Good afternoon, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
So this bill is extremely problematic. And really what it is what's included in the bill, what the bill mandates, which is right. This particularly graphic sex ed curriculum. It not only covers safe sex, but activities like masturbation in picture form. What are they claiming is the purported necessity of a graphic curricula that goes well beyond standard education on biology?
They don't really have a good argument for doing this. I mean, they'll claim we need to address high rates of STIs, STDs, teen pregnancy. But they claim this is really about making sure that the curricula is age appropriate and medically accurate. And as you mentioned in your intro, they call the bill a Healthy Youth Act, which does sound benign.
Sure.
In fact, I had a mom call me and said, hey, I got your email. And, you know, I looked at the bill and it sounds good. It says it's a Healthy Youth Act and it needs age appropriate, medically accurate. So maybe we should support this bill. And so I walked her through, as I've been doing over and over with various people in the media, how this bill actually would work. The problem is, who gets to define what is age appropriate and or medically accurate?
Right.
And the answer that the bill gives is the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, or DESE, as it's called in Massachusetts. They're given authority to define what is appropriate at what age and what's going to be taught, and specifically which curricula will be permitted. And so we went on to the DESE website several years ago when they first started bringing these bills out, And we looked at the curricula they had already approved and said was age appropriate. And I had kids in middle school at the time, so we ordered the middle school curricula, which is not cheap, but we bought it and went through it. And in particular, the curricula from the Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts called Get Real. As you can imagine, a lot of people would not be happy with Planned Parenthood, of all people, teaching their kids about sex.
No, everywhere they go, they happen to take their viewpoint very vociferously with them. So probably not a favorable curriculum to anyone who adheres to a more traditional, conservative, or orthodox perspective.
Of course. But I think even just sort of basic parental common sense, you talk about making you blush. I mean, I read stuff in the seventh grade workbook that, you know, despite being a married father of four and having prosecuted sex crimes in the Marine Corps, there were sex acts described in detail for seventh graders I'd never even heard of before.
Oh, heavens. Well,
you know,
your dad...
Including using... Sorry, go ahead.
You're a dad. You have four kids. I'm a mom of three. We have walked this path, me probably more recently, it sounds like, than you. But I have one in seventh. I have one in ninth. So my biggest concern is naturally this. Is there an opt-out provision or a way that parents who feel that this is wrong, who've done their homework, can really get beyond the invasion of not only parental rights, not only privacy, but what is clearly sexual grooming?
Right. Well, I mean, the good news is under existing Massachusetts law, and also in this bill would be continued, there is a parental opt-out. So for those parents who are aware enough of what's going on and take an affirmative action on their part to let the school know they don't want their child going to this class, they have that right. They also have the right to review the curricula that the school is going to use so they know ahead of time what their child would come in contact to if they took the class, and more importantly, maybe what their classmates are all going to be subjected to, even if they opt their child out. What we found in practice, though, is that despite having those rights, I get phone calls all the time from parents that don't know about that. They call me, you know, after their child's already been exposed to some crazy stuff and try to figure out how that can even be legal. And then, you know, at that point, it's too late. And those are only the parents whose kids actually tell them. And one of the real problems of this bill is that it takes local control away from parents and educators who right now,
Absolutely.
The local school district can decide what's appropriate for the children in their community. This bill gives that power to a state bureaucracy.
And you've got Bessie, who is another bureaucrat determining what's appropriate, what level of sexuality we teach our kids at whatever given age. I don't want to relinquish that right as a parent. And I'm sure you, Andrew, do not either. Listen, we are so grateful for you all at the Massachusetts Family Institute, what you're doing on the ground with the grassroots, how you're educating parents, because truly it is a parent's right to educate these kids in the manner that they see fit according to their own beliefs. Continue doing what you're doing. I've got scholar Dr. Kanta Ahmed from the Independent Women's Forum coming up after the break, and she'll discuss the insidious creep of Iran's influence into nearby Iraq. She thinks the veil may finally be lifting. We'll be right back on Washington Watch.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
A strong case can now be made that China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith, especially Christians, Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, and Falun Gong. The Chinese Communist Party's movement against religion has had and continues to have devastating consequences for those who simply wish to live according to their conscience. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these human rights and religious freedom violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China. That's frc.org/China.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion. Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with 5 kids under the age of 9, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a 6-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It's Friday. I'm Sarah Perry. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com. Remember our podcast website. Share it with your friends. Give us a like and a rating. 5 stars only, please. Tony Perkins, you can follow him on Twitter at T Perkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. And now we turn to Middle East policy. Obviously, all of us have been following the news lately. We understand increasing tensions in Iran and with the United States after Soleimani's death. He made good on his promise, President Trump, after 7 months of planning, lest you listeners believe this was a shoot-from-the-hip moment, as the Democrats would have you believe. But in April 2018, to provide context here, an exclusive Reuters investigation revealed serious evidence of Iran's missile transference to Iraq, its use of Iraq as a forward missile base, and its history of doing the same in Syria and Yemen. Not that you would have heard that in the news, but luckily our commander-in-chief, President Trump, is taking bold steps to expose actions like these. And a few weeks off her visit to Iraq, and joining me now is Dr. Kanta Ahmed, visiting fellow for the Independent Women's Forum, a Muslim scholar, and a USC Shoah Foundation member. Dr. Ahmed, thank you for joining me again on Washington Watch.
It's my absolute pleasure, Sarah. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. I'm curious, you have been there on the ground. Your trip to Iraq must have been full of revelations and first-person encounters. What would you love our listeners to know? What did you experience on the ground that the rest of us who have not had this opportunity don't know?
So it was my third trip in the last 18 months, and in that time I've become particularly close and affiliated to the Iraqi Kurds, because I spend most of my time in Iraqi Kurdistan. And what listeners probably don't realize is that the Kurds are the most pro-American, pro-democratic, pro-Israeli, pro-Western world allies that we have within Sunni Islam. The majority of Kurds are Sunni Muslim, but there are also Kurds that can be Jewish and Kurds that can be Christian, and of course the Yazidis are part of the Kurdish community. And I've been there seeing the aftermath of the genocide that ISIS committed against the Yazidi people, but also a few weeks ago, I was there particularly to look at the refugees that were coming from Rojava because of the Turkish incursion and Turkey's atrocities using former ISIS and similar jihadists to murder Kurds and expel them. So I was there for that. Even though it was a tremendous shock for the Kurdish people in the region that the United States troops were abruptly moved out, something that the president had quite clearly been saying for many years, they still remain deeply affiliated with the United States because of the fact that the Republican presidents, President Bush, the elder, and President G.W. Bush, had secured the creation of a no-fly zone and really led to the autonomy and the salvation of the Kurdish people from genocide permanently in northern Iraq. So most Americans don't realize that, and they are a very important component in that region, which now is in turmoil. I'm so glad you mentioned the Reuters investigation. That was an incredible investigation. It was published, really, and very few people commented on it.
Yes.
But as soon as we saw the events following the elimination of Qasem Soleimani, it made me anticipate that those forward missile bases would be used on U.S. interests. And I'm just waiting for that moment to occur.
Well, speaking of Soleimani and President Trump's actions, he really has made no bones about the fact that he would make good on his promise, that he recognizes Iran as a state sponsor of terror, that Soleimani was a terrorist, and yet we're dealing, for example, with House Democrats, the Speaker, Madam Speaker, for example, who refuses to identify what he actually is, has referred to him as a general and as a commander, but has not identified him for the atrocities that he's committed, not only against the Kurds, but against the United States and against the embassies. Do you feel that he's done enough? And in your estimation, if you could set forth a perfect plan for the president and U.S. involvement in the region, what would that look like?
Wow, that's a tall order. First of all, President Trump is going to go down in history as somebody that confronted what was truly a merchant of death for decades.
Yes.
And there's no question that eliminating Qasem Soleimani, people will battle about the legality of it, but it clearly was the correct and ethical and moral thing to do. The fact that he arrived in Baghdad in a commercial jet was because he wanted to evade possible attempts on his life. He would hide among civilians while he murdered civilians rampantly. His proxies are still operating in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq. One of his proxies, the Mahdi army run by Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric in Iraq that reports to Iran, was one of the most bloodthirsty and lethal enemies of the United States during the time that the U.S. was there in Iraq. So there's no question that that was the right thing to do. It has sent tectonic shocks across the region, and rightly so, and it has finally put Iran on notice. And Iran has really been shaken by that, only to be followed by a second monumental humiliation when they murdered their own citizens in a commercial jet and attempted to cover that up. So I think this is high time that the president has exposed Iran as the leading Islamist sponsor of evolutionary jihadism. The president did more than that, and this people have accused him of making an impulsive decision, but it's not impulsive. In April 2019, the United States designated the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization, which is very important. It allows us to look at the flow of money. So that's excellent. And also, the reason it's a shock and a break to the Democrats is we've had 8 years of Obama doctrine appeasing Iran. And that is actually an extremely frightening story. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps also has huge lobbying components here in the United States and in Canada. And it was their entities, their mouthpieces, the National Iranian American Council here in the United States, the Iranian Canadian Congress in Canada, that influenced lawmakers, legislators, ultimately President Obama's speechwriters, to have a conciliatory tone and attitude towards the Islamist regime. That is why President Obama sat back during the Green Revolution and did not lift a finger. And it is also shockingly why Obama did not respond when the red line was crossed. That was a deal breaker for Iran because they wanted to support Assad. So the number of awful decisions that we've made that have cost human life to appease Iran is shameful, and we now have a chance to change it.
So we know 1,500 protesters have died under this regime. And I know that you met with Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Anapriel, and I'm curious as to whether or not there's an official recognition of the increasing level of protest, of the understanding of and hostility toward the level of genocide and terrorism and human rights violations. Are the citizens of Iran finally fed up with being fed the narrative that we seem to be gobbling up here, which is that things are not as problematic as we've been told they are?
Well, meeting with Deputy Speaker Horami in the Kurdish Regional Parliament, it became clear how the Kurds are really limited because of the power vacuum in Baghdad and the fact that Baghdad is constantly reporting to and being puppeted by Iran. That affects the Kurds because their budget and their oil revenues are held hostage to the interests of Iran. There is no question that the protests that we are now seeing in Iran after the downing of the jet are absolutely authentic. They have torn down posters of Qasem Soleimani. They are saying the United States is not our enemy. The enemy is here in Tehran. And the regime is now extremely fragile. What the president must do, and he's made remarks in his rallies about this, is most definitely the United States stands with the ordinary Iranian people. The United States despises this Islamist regime, and we are going to help in every way the Iranian people to overthrow this regime. This regime, the mood now is revolutionary. They are not going to be placated, the Iranian public. Remember, their economy is cratered by the sanctions that the president has already placed on them after coming out of the Iran deal, and we're tightening those sanctions. They have water shortages as they are dealing with flooding. Their own water mafia, members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, are enjoying the high life in Canada, where they've sought exile and brought their millions out of the country. This is a corrupt, rotten to the core regime that needs to fall. But I agree with President Trump that we will not be, as the United States, responsible for the regime change. The Iranian public will, and we must help them morally and materially. Materially can be satellite phones, Wi-Fi, communications, amplifying their message, not that of the mouthpieces of the regime, who still are sitting on our networks, who are influencing legislators, who are trying to preserve this very decrepit regime. That has to stop.
We know after your discussions on this, after what we read in more honest publications, that this is a regime that has taken some pretty significant hits. There was a sort of flaccid weakness to the attack, and I'm using more air quotes here, the rockets at the U.S. base. We understand that Soleimani was targeted, was planned for, was assassinated, as was precisely designed. So this is a regime that appears now to be a little more bark than bite. And yet Iran has reactivated old Saddam factories and so far helps Shia militia inside Iraq. So is there more to come in this battlefield?
I think we should expect more. People are breathing a sigh of relief, and that we now know that there were 11 American soldiers who've been impacted by some of those missiles, and we pray that they're going to be healthy and safe. So it wasn't completely without any casualties. But they have revealed in how they mishandled and caused the death of 176 civilians that they are reckless, incompetent, and willing to conceal the death of civilians at any cost, not to mention the 1,500 protesters that we know about that have been executed, others that are locked up. We know that Iranian dissidents that speak in the West have been penalized by their families being imprisoned, threatened, or murdered. We know that this regime, the Iranian Revolutionary Corps Guard, operates internationally and is willing to kill, assassinate without impunity, and has done in foreign cities. There was an important assassination of an Iranian intelligence dissident in Istanbul that Secretary Pompeo condemned in November of 2019. So they are a very dangerous force. And they will be doing more political assassinations. They will be attempting more interests that are belonging to U.S. allies or the United States. But ultimately, I think we are seeing them in their waning days. And there is a very powerful Iranian diaspora, over 1 million Iranian Americans here in the United States, many in Canada, many in Europe, who would like nothing more than the demise of this regime. That is why they are living in the diaspora community. So we have to find a way to mobilize them and support the downfall of this regime. And that is also going to require what I believe for the United States to remain in the region. At the very least, I would like to see President Trump augment forces, bases, armaments, special forces advisors in Iraqi Kurdistan, which is where our soldiers are safe, which is where our soldiers vacation. It's where they treasure our flag more than some Americans treasure our flag here in this country. That is where we need to remain as a behemoth and a bugbear next to an increasingly under pressure Iran. And that pressure is not going to lift. We know, you and I, that we are looking at the threshold of the second Trump administration. Yes. I don't think that these policies are going to change. It would be a calamity if Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders became elected, because they would immediately open the floodgates, welcome with open arms the Khamenei regime, and the window will have closed for the Iranian people. So we cannot allow that to happen for our country or for Iran.
We only have a few minutes left. I like to jokingly refer to the Obama administration as the General Apology Tour for his lackadaisical treatment toward terrorist state actors like this. But you talked a little bit about Kurdistan, which is the majority of where we place our U.S. military in the region. But now we've got the risk of Iran and Iraq collaborating to seal off this border, essentially leaving the Kurds in a vacuum. Is the potential for genocide unchecked, or have we made initial steps through President Trump?
You know, Sarah, that's a very intelligent question that you've asked, and I've done a lot of media over the last few months, and nobody's asked me that. That is the greatest fear, is a land bridge opening up between Islamist Turkey and Lebanon across northeast Syria that could isolate the Kurds. It could unite Islamist Iran. It would open up Iranian-puppeted Lebanon, Iranian-puppeted Syria, to threaten Israel. And that cannot be allowed to happen. That is why reconsidering our position in northeast Syria and Rojava is absolutely imperative. That is also why we need to stand with the Kurds in northern Iraq and let them know we are not abandoning you. We are not going to leave you to the genocidal ambitions of Erdogan. All this calamity in Iran and Iran's response post Qasem Soleimani has taken the world's eye off Turkey. Turkey is still committing atrocities against the Kurds. They sit there in Rojava at each individual house in a village. If a villager comes out, they will kill him with sniper wounds. I've seen a list of the deaths of civilians in Rojava, people who are villagers, people who just have children, who have nothing. This is Turkey's ambition. And that is going unsupervised. And I know you're an expert in religious persecution, anti-Semitism, and genocide. And I know how deeply this impacts you. We also should remember the Kurds, that area is the only place that the Christian population is growing in the Middle East other than Israel.
Dr. Ahmed, I have to cut you off. I wish I had more time with you. We'll have you back on the show. Dr. Ahmed with the Independent Women's Forum and a Muslim scholar. We'll be right back on Monday with a new episode of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Looking forward to talking to you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.